This is Jason Lopez with PodTech.net, and I'm here with Lily Mummert of Intel. We're talking about Diamond, a platform for interactive search. My first question, right out of the box, what is Diamond? Is it hardware? Is it software? Is it a combination of both?
At this point, it's software. Okay, so there's sort of two pieces, right? One piece of Diamond is the piece that we refer to as the core. And the Diamond core contains functionality that we think is going to be useful for content-based search. Right. So some of the ideas are, you know, this taking this position of not having indices, right? So that we're going to do brute force search, right? But we're going to be smart about it. We're going to try to ship the query to closer to the location of the data, so that the data can be irrelevant matches can be discarded early. We're going to provide some self-tuning capabilities so that the system dynamically adapts based on what the query is and what the data is and what the relative processing capabilities of the different nodes are.
For those that are not familiar with what non-index search means, can you compare this to what you do when you, let's say, go to Google and search?
Okay. So what non-index search means... When we talk about indexing data, one way to look at that is that you are trying to organize the data in such a way to anticipate the most important queries. Okay, so you know, if I have a collection of images, perhaps I might label them with their contents: horse, you know, picture of kid, whatever. Right. What Diamond does is it does not require this kind of labeling. Diamond takes the position that there's going to be so much data, one, and that the data is going to be so complex that it's going to be difficult to know what the queries are going to be, and therefore it's difficult to know what to index for, okay? Particularly when you have high-dimensional data, you know, MRIs or X-rays or, you know, sound. The question would be, what would you index in that kind of data? So Diamond takes the position that we're not going to assume any index at all, right? It can certainly work. There's certainly middle ground here between the index model and the non-index model. And we can certainly take advantage of indices if they're there. But if they're not there, you still need to be able to do search.
I was talking to someone who's a search guru over at Yahoo.
Okay.
And he said that the kind of search that we are expecting these search engines to do and the hardware, the software together is tantamount to artificial intelligence in a way.
Okay. I can see where he's going with that. So certainly the kind of searches we've been doing have been quite simple. Right. If you think of a record-based search, give me all employees with, you know, start date of something and salary range of this, and or, you know, Google image search, give me pictures of horses, right? These are fairly simple. The applications that we're thinking about in some ways will also be simple, but at a much higher level of abstraction, right? So a doctor looking at an MRI and looking at a feature in the MRI might point to the feature and say, find me things that look like this. But describing that down at a low level is quite a bit harder.
Right, right. I see that. So the applications for this kind of search lend themselves to the way that we interact with the world. We don't go to the store thinking keywords.
No, right.
You know, we go thinking products that we need or we want.
Right. We think of examples. Yeah. Right. Something like this. Right. The terms we use might be a little vague. You know, we think of this as a very interactive process where we sort of come up with a vague search and then refine it as we go, improve it as we go. We may think of, in addition to example-based search or similarity search, right? Similarity search covers a lot of ground, right? How do you define what is similar? That's a very hard problem.
And one of the things you mentioned in the video was that this kind of search could have a big impact on just simple things.
Right. So back to the idea of similarity search. I mean, it's to us saying, find me something that's similar to this. I mean, that to us seems very simple, right? But that turns out to be a very hard thing to do. So if you can provide, you know, a tool that will find you similar matches, right, and let you look at, say, previous diagnoses, right, this could improve diagnosis overall dramatically.
Okay, thank you so much for the podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you. so much.
I am Babu Pillai. I am from the Intel Research Lab in Pittsburgh, and we're a lablet wholly owned by Intel that's working closely with Carnegie Mellon University doing exploratory research in a wide variety of areas. And the topic I'm talking to you today is what we call dynamic physical rendering, also known as claytronics at Carnegie Mellon University. We want to fundamentally change how not only we interact with computers, but the kind of things computers can do in the physical world. One of the things we should, at least more near-term kind of things, is we're going to be able to change the physical shape, the morphology of computing devices under software control. So one example might be is, can you imagine you have your cell phone? It's really great for making phone calls, but when you need to, you know, check your calendar, enter some notes or something, it's really inconvenient. At that time, you would really like to have a full-size keyboard that you can type on. At the same time, maybe later, you want to watch a movie and you'd like to have a huge screen that, you know, definitely won't fit in your pocket. Can you imagine if your cell phone could actually physically change to actually match the application you're trying to use at the current time? That would be like the ultimate kind of portable device.
Okay, now I have to stop you. What are you talking about?
So what we're talking about is actually a technology that produces that is a form of programmable matter. And the matter is actually what we think of is it's composed of small, tiny robots, which are really little bits of silicon in spherical shape that kind of interact with each other, can move against each other, and can communicate and compute, and given the right software, can produce these shapes dynamically.
How would you make your cell phone into a larger screen television?
So, first of all, we're not creating material, of course, right? So we're working with what's there. And we can imagine instead of your cell phone being made of these discrete large parts, imagine it's made of a kind of a uniform material that can produce colors, can produce light, might have little tiny LEDs on them or something, have maybe thermal and magnetic sensors, and can actually move. So we have, at one scale, kind of a material that can form whatever shape, including the cell phone shape. And if these things can move against each other properly, we can actually change that shape, flatten it out into a larger screen, and then use the whole screen as a display, for example.
Has this actually happened yet?
Oh, of course not. This is definitely our vision. So all I've told you so far is our vision. What we've actually been looking at is what are the technologies needed to actually even think about such a material, you know, both in terms of hardware, you know, what are the little robots, what should they look like to make them even manufacturable? Can they actually even move against each other? We started looking into that a little bit. And I think what's more significant problem is, how do you actually make them do this? How do you control them? It's not, you know, if you have a million of these things, they're still not going to do anything until you tell them exactly what you want to do. How do you actually do this? How do they communicate with each other? And how do they work together to do something coherent? That's actually a significant software challenge that kind of goes beyond just this project into a wide variety of things. Once we start thinking of terascale computing in all its manifestations, now how do you allocate resources? How do you tell these guys to work together without incurring extreme costs in terms of communications? We're working a lot with algorithms that can scale what we call sublinearly, so that, you know, as we add a number of modules to the system, we don't actually increase the runtime, increase the complexity. We've looked at several aspects of that, including how do we make sure everybody works synchronously, things like that. So from us, I think the real interesting points are actually the software. And we're really working hard on trying to build the software infrastructure so that we can actually build these things in the future. At the same time, we are working with Carnegie Mellon to actually think about, you know, can we bootstrap the process of building hardware to do that could be used for these things, at least on the macro scale. So our ultimate vision, like we see in the video over there, is actually we require really tiny robots and a lot of them. Can we think of more near-term applications that could make do with larger scale, maybe centimeter scale robots, a fewer of them that we can maybe deal with in the near term? And we do have one such application that I would like to talk to you about. It's called what we call programmable antennas. There's been a lot of work recently on software-defined radios or reconfigurable radios But the physical infrastructure for the radio, the antenna, the actual transmitting device, is often fixed because it's a complex piece of complex shape. It's manufactured once, you can't change it. But imagine if now they're made of this kind of reconfigurable hardware that can be now changed, or we can change the shape under software control. Now we change to a different type of radio application. Antenna changes shape maybe from a monopole that broadcasts everywhere to maybe a more reflector dish that projects in one direction. That's a humongous change in the way radios are done today. And that's something we think may happen in the next 10 years or so. That's more near.
Well, I got to say, it either comes off as Bill Joy's nightmare or something from Terminator.
Yeah, but, we don't want to come off so sinister. I think it's, but it is a game-changing technology.
No, it is absolutely fascinating. And I look over at the board here at some of the things that it could allow us to do. Just incredible that we could actually manipulate physical structures like this.
Yeah, and of course we're not doing magical things. I mean, you know, the device is still going to weigh the same no matter what the shape. You're just adapting the shape to be more convenient to the user. And similarly, we had enough of this material, we can possibly use it for all kinds of different types of entertainment type things. We can think of 3D television, where the scene is on your table or something, like on your desktop, rather than behind the glass viewing screen. Well, those are the kinds of things we envision. And we hope that we can answer some of the really hard software development and computer science questions that we need to solve along the way in the next 10 years or so.
Well, Babu, it sounds like you are having a blast with what you're working on.
Absolutely.
And very lucky to be working in something so incredibly fascinating. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I'm Marzia Polito. I work for Intel Corporation in the Application Research Lab. What we're doing in this project, we've worked on a technology for summarizing large collection of web pages. The idea is that when you do a web search, you can retrieve a lot of pages that are relevant to your topic. And what you would like to do is to have the computer automatically provide you a summary of all the web pages that are returned to that query. And that's what this system does automatically. It selects a few sentences among all these documents that are relevant and also non-overlapping, tries to not give you the same information twice or more than twice. This is a few examples. This search was Intel Vive, and this was just from 20 pages, and it returned the top four sentences. And you can see that for such a small collection of documents, the runtime is still at a good level, so it's an online task. But our claim is that to perform this task properly, meaning really help you to kind of navigate in the huge amount of data that you have on the web, you need to process way more than 20 pages. I mean, we're talking thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of documents, and for that you need terascale machines. You need machines that can process a lot of documents at the same time, so you can have many jobs happening at the same time, that have large memories to keep all these documents in memory and so accelerate the computations. And you need to be able to perform a lot of applications at the same time.
What kind of companies would use this, and what kinds of ways would they use it?
The way I see this application is working as a software on the client machine, so a software company, as a post-processing of results of web search. So maybe to work in conjunction with a web search company, meaning in collaboration, meaning there's a server that returns you the search results and then you work with them. The other possibility that we are thinking of is you can have some kind of personalized local web search engine that maybe during the night downloads a lot of web pages that might be interesting according to your interests, goes around the web, and then in the morning provides you summaries, and then maybe you have queries on those documents that immediately can provide you a little summary according to your query. So this is targeted for, you know, software that would run on the client and maybe in conjunction with some web searches engine.
Now, this would be the kind of tool that could be equated to something like LexisNexis in its ability to cull large amounts of data and give you really something meaningful. And it seems like what we're looking at here with this local web summarization is the ability to get to a lot of information without having to go through that,
exactly.
that process. Now, how relevant is this going to be for me at home, in a sense, doing my own research on the web?
Well, you first of all, if this runs on your own computer, the system might be aware of what your personal tastes are and more likely has been able before to kind of like retrieve what your kind of like detect what your tastes are from the material that's in your machine, what you've searched before, and a lot of information that's there. So if you do it locally on your own machine, you will be able to have results returned that are just for yourself and are tuned to your taste. If you're a soccer fan and you look for a game, it's probably going to know already that you're a soccer fan, so it's going to return your results that are more about soccer games instead of another kind of games. And there's
but how can my computer do that if it takes terascale computing?
Because your computer is hopefully going to be a terascale machine.
Ah, okay. That's the...
oh, sorry. I didn't say
that's
that.
That's the hitch in all of this.
Or maybe I forgot
not the
that
hitch.
Sentence.
That's the good news in all of this. Okay.
The good news is the computer will be a terascale machine in a few years, but it will be. So among the tasks of our group is trying to figure out which application it's interesting to kind of tune the terascale machine to. So if we have more powerful machine, we don't want to do more powerful machine to do the task that the machine today do. You want to find what else? What else can you do there?
But I'm just thinking that maybe what you've come up with here is something that might be valuable in and of itself as a kind of web product.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we're publishing results about our research, so it's not.
It's not a secret what it can do.
Yeah. It's not a secret. This is not a secret. The research we do is usually, most of it we end up publishing on or bringing around in research conferences. So this is actually going to be at an information retrieval conference. So that's...
This is just to test the
this
machines
is a prototype.
To make sure
this is a prototype. This
work.
Is research work. Yeah. But we can produce some prototype code and application that then our architect can use for testing the new machines that they have in mind.
I see.
Yeah, this can have a separate research value by itself, and actually that's a good thing with it. And the problem of summarizing documents, of course, it's not a new information retrieval problem. What is new here is, first of all, that we're targeting that to web pages, which hasn't been done much yet, and also that we're using a technique that is at the same time geared to find important information and not non-overlapping information. So that's the novelty of it.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it.
My name is Jim Hurley. I'm a principal engineer at Intel's Corporate Technology Group in the microprocessor workload investigation, I guess you could call it. Part of our job is to look at what we believe are imminent or future workloads, plausible future workloads, that we investigate to understand what are the requirements to satisfy the workloads and therefore what the future processors have to have to support that workload. And it could be as simple as just how many MIPS do you need and what kind of bandwidth, or it could be, you know, special features or capabilities or instructions or whatever the processor might need to have to better perform such workloads.
What does this mean, real-time ray tracing on a PC? How does this impact a user?
So for most users, this will probably impact them from the point of view of entertainment applications like games. It also would directly impact content creators, both for the games, because they have, although they use different tools to go about their business, those tools exercise a lot of the same kinds of things as the game playing engine does at the back end. And movie content creators also, both the content creation pipeline and the production pipeline of the movie. And it, you know, given now that Microsoft has implemented 3D graphics into the GUI, this could also impact that. I don't know exactly how Microsoft might use ray tracing as distinct from raster graphics in the GUI, but raster graphics has certain limitations that ray tracing doesn't have. So it could allow them to create a richer GUI environment, and that would affect everybody who uses a PC if they were to go down that path at some stage in the future.
What are we looking at here? How is ray tracing affecting this image or creating this image?
So this particular image is a Thai statuette from the Stanford repository, and this statuette has been scanned in using a laser scanner, and the model has 10 million polygons in it, which is a model that's way more complex than you could render with a GPU today. This particular model is being rendered using multiple light sources, and it's casting exact shadows. You can see that shadows are falling from the object onto other parts of the same object, which typically you can't do really well on a GPU. You couldn't render this because you couldn't even fit this on the GPU's memory. But the purpose of this is to demonstrate one of the values or one of the primary advantages of ray tracing, and that is that ray tracing has a logarithmic cost to it. So if I had this Thai statuette, which has 10 million polygons, and another one that had 100 million polygons, instead of it costing me 10 times more to render it, it would only cost me twice as much. What that translates into is if I was, let's say, a game creator building a game world, I don't have to worry about the complexity of the game world so much. And I don't have to do a lot of pre-processing of, like, visibility maps. So if I'm here and you're there, can I see you or not? I can just let the rays find you. And, you know, if there's, let's say, this entire building is the game world and we're here in this room, well, the cost of me rendering, let's say, my vision of you is based on how many polygons you are, whereas I don't have to worry about any cost associated with the rest of the building itself. Whereas a rasterizer doesn't know one triangle from another, has to render every single triangle, and when the last triangle ends up on the screen, now you have your final image. So if I increase the cost of the model by 10x, I increase the rendering cost by 10x. Also, raster graphics devices, they have no idea the relationship of the triangles. As I said earlier, it's one triangle at a time, completely independently of the others. So if I want to create a realistic-looking image with shadows and reflections and things like that, I have to take many passes. One pass, let's say, to calculate the shadow for this light, another pass to calculate the shadow for some other light, a shadow to create a map that gets used for reflection, and that reflection is not precise, it's just plausible. Whereas with ray tracing, I shoot the ray in, it hits something, and from where it hits, I can shoot a ray at each light, or I can bounce the ray off that object, and I only process what I need to process, and everything is exact and precise. So from a content creator's point of view, game content creator, movie content creator, what you see is what you get. It works exactly the way it's supposed to work. And there are no limitations that manifest themselves in a game, for instance, as restrictions. So, for instance, there are a lot of games that have brick textures on walls. If the camera gets too close to looking at the wall on edge, it becomes obvious the wall is really flat and the bricks are just painted on. To prevent that from happening, they put pillars in your way or they won't let the camera go certain places and things like that. And there's many, many, many examples of restrictions that end up costing the content creator lots of time, but he has to have some number of engineers along with his artists to make sure that they engineer their way around all these situations where the suspension of disbelief breaks down. Now, using ray tracing for another thing that because of the complexity argument is it makes it more convenient for a movie content creator to provide content that could be used in the game version of the movie that's more faithful to the experience in the movie itself. The downside, though, of course, is the director gets to control everything you see in the movie, whereas in the game version, somebody else is driving the camera around. So they have, you know, they get one saving grace, but they have another cost that they have to worry about.
Does your name get mentioned in the game developer blogs?
No.
It has, hasn't it?
It has. I mean, we've published numbers of papers and things like that, but we pretty much sort of keep our heads down here and just try to get, because this is a lot of technical work that we do. I mean, getting ray tracing to work close to real time on a PC was a lot of work. It's like 4 years worth of effort. It's something that was sort of dabbled in years ago and put aside because it was just too expensive. And people went down this raster graphics path because it was a number of ways of approximating the results that were good enough. And because it got sort of put on the side for a while and ignored, we found that there were a number of easy ways to bring up its speed. But then we ran out of gas on those, and we had to get really advanced in the techniques that we use. And quite frankly, I was surprised that, because every few years in my career, we would go and test when will ray tracing be plausible. And it was always very expensive and very far into the future. And it's only really in the last 3 or 4 years that we came to the conclusion that it's much more imminent than we thought. New approaches that were discovered, the recent trend of having more and more processors is very helpful to us because this scales linearly with the number of cores. Every time you double the number of cores, you double the performance. And Moore's Law takes over at that point in time. It's only a question of time before the amount of computational resources are there to accelerate ray tracing. But the thing that probably was most critical was managing the bandwidth required. We figured out ways to shoot beams of rays. Instead of one ray at a time, we'd shoot a collection of them simultaneously. And that allowed us to multiply the performance of the ray tracer so that a combination of treating multiple rays as one effectively and shooting the rays carefully allows us to cut down the amount of external bandwidth that's required. And that's really what was slowing the CPU down the most, is the thin thread to the external memory. GPUs solved that problem by having many memory channels to expensive local memory that they have. And they've got lots of bandwidth, 30 gigabytes per second, for instance, and CPUs don't have that. But because of the way the caches work on CPUs and the advances we've made, 99% of the memory references get resolved in the cache and not make it out to the main memory. And so as a result, it turned out to be more plausible than we thought at first that ray tracing would be usable in real time on a PC.
Looks like you've got a pretty big PC here. This probably isn't something you would normally find in someone's home.
Well,
right?
this is actually a Conroe system, so you will be seeing people having these imminently. I forget exactly which month we're releasing Conroe. Sometime during the summer. This system will be a mainstream system that we're pushing out this year. And this is going down the trend of having more and more cores. I believe this one has 2 cores on the die, and then, you know, inevitably 4 cores, 8 cores, 16 cores will come. And besides any other multipliers like the frequency or whatever, ray tracing will just multiply along with the number of cores.
I could see having what is almost like supercomputing power in the hands of developers. They're going to love this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think, in fact, in the next 3 to 5 years, ray tracing will give the traditional raster graphics approach a run for its money.
Well, thank you so much, Jim, for the podcast. Appreciate it.
Good luck.